Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Welcome to the IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Today, we are talking about three keys to writing an exceptional IEP. Joining us today for our conversation is Megan Ward, and she is from the IEP Academy. Megan studied at the University of Oregon. She has a bachelor's in elementary education and a master's in special education. She has 11 years experience in the world of special education, five teaching life skills, and 10 years in a resource room. This last year, she's been coaching new special education teachers. Megan, through the IEP Academy, I'm going to let her kind of give you some more information, but she really offers some wonderful trainings and support for teachers in the world of special education. And she is going to provide us some fantastic insight on present levels, classroom functioning, and disability impact in the classroom to help you write that exceptional IEP and as a parent be able to better understand what an exceptional IEP looks like. Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Tell me a little bit about the IEP Academy and the greatness that you guys are providing.
So the IEP Academy is right now just a platform for different types of training that we can offer to teachers in schools to help get the base of special education down a little bit better. There are online courses that go over the basics of the IEP and what that is. And then we also are going to be offering workshops that we have planned, but we're kind of waiting until we get post-pandemic to be able to offer them in person again. But in the meantime, we're working on figuring out how to turn those virtual. And then we also do consulting with schools or districts, which would kind of even broaden the horizon a little bit more about what we do to those. We customize those to what they're looking for.
And why did you come up with this as a need?
This I've been working on for about 5 years, actually. And I saw it as a need because I worked mostly with ninth grade students. And so I would always inherit students who were brand new to me. And it was so hard to figure out what was going on in the IEP. I didn't really understand what the goals they were working on. I didn't know the student very well based on that document. And so I started really working hard on, if I'm passing my IEP to somebody else, what is everything they need to know so that they know the student well and can serve them well without having to spend that time getting to know them?
So just taking it a step back, for folks that may or may not know, what is an IEP?
It's an individualized education plan or program. Those two P's get interchanged. But it's essentially the plan that we put together for any students who qualify for special education services to meet their needs. There's something, and it could vary for every student, but something that might be getting in their way, some barriers to accessing general education. And so it's just a plan of how we're going to support them at the school to try and help bridge that gap.
And what, as a parent, could I expect to see in an IEP? If I was a new parent, I received word that my student was going to be receiving special education support and they were going to develop this IEP for my student, what can I expect to see?
I think the IEP can really get broken down into three big pieces. So typically, and they vary from district to district, but typically the first part describes the student. What are their strengths, their weaknesses? How is their disability affecting them in the school? That can be a very long part of it, but that's kind of the first thing. So painting the picture. Part two is the goals that they're working on. So we identify areas of weakness and then as a team pick goals that we're going to put in place for that student to help them bridge that gap. And then part three is the services that we would offer. So that could be the accommodations. It's a specially designed instruction that teachers or somebody will give. And it could also be a related service if they have other services involved in their plan.
So that first component, that lengthy component that describes the student and kind of outlines what they're doing, how they're doing, does that have a special name to that?
It has a lot of names. In my area in Oregon, they call it the PLAF, so the present levels of academic achievement and functional performance. Some others, there's too many acronyms. Some other places call it the PLOP, present levels of performance. And there's variations around that. Those are probably the most two common. Another way to sum it up easier is just their present levels.
As a parent, what can I, you know, kind of help me, walk me through? And even as an educator, you know, can you talk more about PLOP and what that present level looks like and what completes and defines, I guess, better that present level of performance?
Depending on how your program gets set up with the district that you use, you list off student strengths, you list off their weaknesses, and then the academic achievement part is asking you to lay out where they're at as far as just academics, reading, writing, and math. So that includes where they're at compared to where they should be with their grade level, and then any recent academic educational testing that we have to put that in there as well. And then functional really asks for just about everything else that's not reading, writing, and math or not academic. So how is their activity, how they function in class, mostly executive functioning skills, but this could also be speech. This could be physical impairments. That the functional part is really wide open. And then the last bit of it is how their disability affects them in the general education classroom.
And then who completes or identifies all that information? That's a lot of information, right? So you're trying to capture a student and it's within that academic year, or are you trying to capture that student for all the years that they've had special education and an IEP?
A little bit of both. You want their present levels, so where they're at right now, but you also want a little bit of background to know, like academic testing, for example, doesn't always happen every year, at least not the formal evaluations. And so those might be a few years old, but you still want that information in there to kind of see where they were at that time compared to their same aged peers. And it just helps gives you a little bit of guide of where they might be at. Hopefully they've made progress over those years, but it still kind of helps you show if they're just a couple years behind or maybe 5 or 6 years behind. And that information is gathered. Typically the final product is the case manager or the special education teacher, but ideally they are getting that information from parents, from their teachers, from school psychologists who have done the evaluations, and even from the student.
So they're doing the case manager that's responsible for supporting that student, ensuring that they're having success. They're the ones that are gathering that information and asking the questions from parents and staff and other players that support that student.
Absolutely, yeah.
What would you recommend as, do you have like key points that you feel are a must? And you've mentioned some, but do you feel like when you kind of say it over as you're training staff and you're training special educators and parents as like what they need to look for to build a really strong present level?
Yeah. So that's the top three pieces I think that everyone needs to have in their PLOP or PLAF, whatever that area is that you call it. The first one is their present levels. I think that's the most important one we need. We need to know where they're at with whatever skill it is that we're focusing on with them. You don't have to know where they're at in everything, but you need to know where we're at. If we've identified reading, writing, and study skills as their goal areas, we've got to have a very clear picture of where they're at on reading, writing, and study skills. So that present level, and that can be gathered all kinds of different ways. But too often, I see just numbers with no context in it, or just, you know, Johnny made progress this year on reading. But I don't know what that means when I get that as a new teacher. Yeah. So nailing down exactly kind of where they're at with each of those levels. And also part two to that is what do we need to focus on with them to help them bridge that gap between where they're at and skills they need in the general education curriculum.
Right. To drive the other parts of that IEP.
Yeah. So that's part one.
That's part one. Okay.
That's part one. Part two then is what I call classroom functioning. And it's not actually a required part of the IEP, but I put it in all of mine and I try to teach people to put it in theirs as well. And that part just includes what does it look like in the classroom for them? What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? What might trigger them in the classroom? What helps them do really well? So what's maybe some success stimuli for them? Something that helps bring out the best in them, but it just gives a picture so that the general education teacher is able to be, or actually any staff that's working with the student, is able to be proactive with that student rather than reactive and kind of learning by experience. If we can paint a pretty good picture beforehand, then they'll know from the start how to set that student up with success, which will help them build a better relationship and gain trust with that student.
I think that's incredibly important to have that component. And I have to say, out of my many, many, many years in special education, I don't too often see that. And so I think training educators to know to put that in there in terms of what do they like, what do they look like in the class, how does that really transition, and also how does that transition to the real world?
Absolutely.
You know, and thinking through the goals, like, are your goals applicable to the real world? Does this make sense? Because, you know, we are looking to build our kiddos through free and appropriate education for future education, performance, success, independent living. And so I think that will all integrate together so that you're really making sure that you're looking at big picture and little picture when you're doing this IEP.
Yeah. And then the third part to that, to the kind of three things I think everyone needs to make sure they really get down, is how the disability affects them in the general education setting. So just so many people, general education teachers, know by experience, and maybe they did some training of their own, but even as any parent would know, one disability does not look the same in one student as it does in another. So we really need to paint a picture of how this student's disability affects them. And some ADHD is a great example. Some teachers might just, you know, say they're hyper, they can't sit down, they, you know, whatever. But if we can kind of paint that picture as to why that student needs to get up, or why that student needs a movement break, why that student needs to kind of have a seat in the back of the classroom so that they can stand when needed. If we can paint that picture, then we can put services and accommodations in place that make sense to the teacher, that they'll do because they know why they're doing them. And then we can help set that student up for success.
So what happens if a parent does not necessarily agree with the present level? They get their draft IEP, they're at the IEP table, and they're hearing what's being reported in the classroom and what's being seen as an academic or where that student is academically, but the parent just does not agree or does not feel like that's a good picture of what their student is capable of.
Hopefully what the team would do is then have a discussion about that. Hopefully kind of both sides could show what they see and paint the picture. And my recommendation would be ask questions from both sides. Parents, ask questions. Maybe they're just not understanding. Maybe someone on the team didn't describe it very well. So maybe it paints kind of the wrong picture of what the student is like. So that would be my hope. Sometimes it does get a little more contentious. They kind of butt heads a little bit on that. But I just hope that they would have open communication and then reword it a little bit. And honestly, parents know their student better than we do. And so maybe what we're seeing looks different, you know, looks different from the outside looking in, but the parent is seeing something else. And so maybe by getting their input on that, we can kind of rework something, because maybe if we did something a little bit different, that behavior we're seeing won't even be there anymore.
Which kind of brings up something in my head in terms of parent input statements. Mm-hmm. You know, the present level of performance is really kind of outlined there again by that case manager, the special education teacher. But the parent input statement is equally as valuable and super important in driving and crafting that IEP. Mm-hmm. So I guess to answer, maybe to kind of add to that conversation, is that if that special education teacher reached out and had that conversation about how does the parent see that student, what are their strengths, what are their weaknesses, and kind of then be able to develop an IEP with that lens.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The more that line of communication can be open, prior to the meeting, during the meeting, after, all year long, the better.
If parents have an outside or private evaluation done, what happens if that present level of performance is different from the schools?
That's a tough one. I think what we would do in my experience is we would share with our school psychologists, who are the ones who do our evaluations, and have them look over it and kind of get their judgment on what they think. It could just be that, you know, those tests that they do are a snapshot of the student in that day in that setting. And so they may not always be exactly accurate. So I would recommend we bring them in and we kind of look at both of them and compare them and then see. And if they're starkly different, then potentially do a third it'd really be up to the team on where we're at with that. But those evaluations, it could be the student was more comfortable in the other setting. Maybe they were having a really bad day in one setting. And so kind of taking all those factors into consideration and figuring out where we meet in the middle of those results.
So how can parents, or how can we help support parents to fully understand these IEP documents?
I think during the meeting, making sure that you're going through it slowly and kind of before you move on to the next section, ensuring, asking, you know, does that make sense? Are you comfortable with this discussion and whatnot, rather than just blasting through them? And also giving them an opportunity maybe to chat with you in a less formal setting. Maybe they can meet with you just one-on-one to go through it, or on the phone. But just, I think communication is the biggest thing. I always come back to that one. Make it comfortable so that they know and trust that they, when they ask a question, that you'll answer it and make them feel heard and valued, and not scoff at that they don't know what this section of the IEP is.
And I find that honestly, because of the many players at an IEP table, that there are times that even professionals are at the table that don't understand elements of it. And that can be anyone at the table. And there's so many people at the table. And I think it is very important to create that relationship, to send that IEP draft home, to have a conversation with the parents, to make sure that they fully feel like a member of that team. Because oftentimes parents walk in and it's like a boardroom and there's people with lots of different titles and they don't really understand and feel comfortable in their element. And as you mentioned earlier, the world of IEP has so many acronyms, yep, that it doesn't matter how educated you are, that it's a very different language. And so really, as the special educator, to ensure that they reach out to bridge that gap with the parent, and the parent does the same to start that relationship and to ask questions and to ensure that they're, and hopefully that's what our conversation is doing today, to mm-hmm. providing some information so that parents feel more comfortable in understanding this process.
Yeah. And ideally, as a case manager, hopefully that IEP meeting is not the first time you've talked with that parent. So that's even if you've never met them in person, hopefully you've talked on the phone with them, have had positive conversations before then. And if you haven't, then I would encourage it. Try to establish that relationship, even if it's just over the phone beforehand, so that when they come into that meeting, at least they have kind of one friendly face or one friendly person that they know they feel good about.
Is there a helpful resource that explains all the acronyms for families? You know, with such a dense document, you know, what are the must read, clarify pages or sections of the IEP for a parent?
Every year at meetings, they send home that booklet of the parent rights, although it's not the easiest thing to read. If you've ever gone through it, it's pretty dense and it doesn't even cover everything about the IEP. It actually just goes over your rights. So there's a lot more to the IEP than even that booklet covers. There are some good websites out there. My favorite to go to and to recommend people is understood.org. They have a lot of good information. You do have to do a little bit of searching once you get there, but it has a ton of good resources. And then that's one of the most common requests I've actually heard as we're kind of starting to build things, is explaining all this to parents. And so my next thing that I want to work on building is that resource for parents, is kind of breaking down the IEP in every section of what it is, what should be there, and what they, how they could help contribute to it.
How are areas of concern evaluated? So who can submit these areas of concern? So on the IEP, you know, giving that data, how are these concerns evaluated?
Typically, the concern section is just inputting parent concerns. You could also add teacher concerns in that area, but most of them just have a section for parent concerns. And hopefully, the way I train is to ask those concerns right at the beginning of the meeting. Even if you, so that we have them written down, and even if we don't address them all right then and there, then we know to make sure that when they come up, when that section of the IEP comes up, when we get to that, that we address that concern. But another thing I would encourage is actually connect with the parent before the meeting. Ask them to get their concerns. They could submit them in writing, and I would recommend they submit them in writing. But if you have a good relationship with a parent, maybe you just have that conversation on the phone. But then also, as a case manager, I try to train, keep listening for those as a meeting goes on, because it can be overwhelming. And sometimes some come up that remind them of something as we were going. So don't just write down either the written concerns they submitted or the first thing they said at the beginning of the meeting. Write them all down as we go, And then the other thing I like to do that I train on is keep them in there from the year before. Some people delete last year's concerns, but I really like to keep them in there because I want to make sure that we're not making that mistake again, or that that concern is no longer a concern of that parent.
You can certainly date that too, right? Like just, yep. This is from this school year. Here's our new school year. How do you encourage folks to write down those concerns? And then what is the next step, right? So one step is to hear, yes, I have these concerns, but then what is the next step to acting upon them?
Depends on what the concern is. Some of it could just be questions that we answer right there in the meeting, and that could address them. It might have just been a confusion over something. It could be changing a service or an accommodation, working on editing the IEP as we're working on it that day. Or it could be bigger picture things, like if it's a student and a teacher having a poor relationship and there being conflict with those two. So it could be something that we work on ongoingly. And so it really depends on what the concern is. But then even within the concern section, I would add a little bit of what's the action plan from there. So parent, you write down their concern, this question they had. And then after that sentence in parentheses, write down, we were able to answer this question in the IEP meeting. So we kind of know that it got addressed. If they had a concern that could be solved with an accommodation, note that in. Team chose to add this accommodation to the plan. Or if it's the bigger one, like that conflict with the teacher, it could be case manager, we'll follow up and, you know, meet with that teacher and the student, something to that effect. So it really varies how you address them, but I would at least, at the very least, note what the plan is coming away from that meeting, so that when you send home all that paperwork, it's very clear to everyone, here's what we want to look at and here are the steps we're taking to make sure that we address these concerns.
And I would even take it a step further as well, Megan, that's great advice, to really note who is going to be responsible for that taking step, right? So you said the special educator is going to consult with the general education teacher, X, Y, and Z. So really kind of making sure everybody has their assigned role, because too often I've even found in my experience as a special educator and sitting at that table, it ends up being the case manager's responsibility if it's not delegated to other folks that are
Absolutely.
On the team.
Yep. Yeah, that's a very good point. So a lot of things fall under that role if they're not delegated out. That's a very good point.
Absolutely. Moving on from our present level. So we have our parent input statement. We have our present levels of performance. We have this clear picture, this narrative of our students, their performance, their strengths, their pockets of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. What are goals and objectives?
Goals and objectives. So the goals, like we talked about before, are the areas we really want to focus in on with that student. So they have a barrier or a gap between where they're at and where they would be expected to be for their grade level. And we want to bridge that gap. So that's the areas of focus that we set that barrier in. It could be because the student has a reading disability, and so we're really going to focus in on reading. And so that would be the goal area. And then objectives are part of the goal, and they break that goal down into smaller pieces.
So how do teachers measure goals and objectives?
That is a fabulous question. That's a big one. You can do all kinds of training and classes just on goals and objectives. First step, I think, is the way you write them. It really matters on what you pick in the goal and the way you write them. I don't know if you remember, but a few years back, they really got focused on standards-based IEPs and having all goals based on standards. But I think what happened there was some schools or districts interpreted that as grade level standards. And so if a student was in 10th grade, then they should be working towards 10th grade standards. But every 10th grader is working towards 10th grade standards. We don't need to write an IEP for that. We already have it in the plan. So really what I think the intention was for, you know, here's that 10th grade standard that we want them to hit, but now we need to look backwards. And as we set our goal, rather than just saying reading comprehension, go back and look intentionally. All right, they're reading roughly at a sixth grade level. So what's a sixth grade standards-based goal that kind of fits that area, and base it off that? But even with that, I still don't recommend it writing based off the standards, or I don't recommend it writing it word for word from the standards, because the standards can be pretty hard to interpret sometimes, and they don't make a whole lot of sense to anyone who's not teaching that subject. So I would say base it off the standards, but then word it in a way that's going to help bridge that gap in a way that's measurable. That's the problem with when we go off of standards. It's not necessarily measurable. So you can have a standards-based goal, but word it appropriately so that we know, you know, if it's comprehension, that how many questions on what grade level passage is this student going to be answering? Or if it's a more arbitrary goal, make up a scale right within that goal of how you were going to measure it. I like to do 4-point scales. It all, but the basis is you've got to make sure that you write it well from the start to be able to measure it well in the end.
If a goal seems too broad or vague, how can parents get clarity?
Ask a zillion and a half questions. And then through that discussion, hopefully you can kind of narrow down into the exact right skill that we really want to practice in with the student. And I think people try to keep it broad because they think, well, everything is important. And it is. But we can only work on so many things at a time. So what's the, you know, the key skill with reading, for example, that is going to really help the student kind of find success and then be able, next time we can build upon the next one. So which one's first? What's our foundation that we need to set?
So kind of going back to the goals and measuring, do you have a system that you feel is accessible for educators as they're tracking data and measuring improvements for a student?
I am in love with using Google Forms. What we do is each student has a Google form that they have assigned to them. Their goals are written in there. And then we have the measurement kind of in a multiple choice, like the different options that you can pick are multiple choice, plus teachers can add narratives. And so we send that out to teachers. They fill out the form, they send it back. And that's a really great way because every time you need to track, you need to pull data, send it again, they have it and all stays within the same form. And then Google Forms is one, free, but two, actually even gives you amazing graphs that just make it very, very clear on where the student is at. And there's all kinds of fun things you can do with it from that. But even if all you did was a basic Google form, it's all your data collected in one area. And it's very clear of where the teachers felt the student was at each given time point in the year.
So you mentioned a 4-point system. What does that mean? Not every IEP has a 4-point system attached.
No, I got the 4 points from proficiency grading. And so I don't know where the schools are across the across the states, but we in Oregon, we all often do proficiency grading based on a 1 through 4. So 1 is basic, 2 is emerging, 3 is proficient, and 4 is exceeding expectations. And so I kind of base my goals, if they don't have a natural way to measure, for example, a study skills goal, if you want a student to, or actually a better one, I think, is a self-advocacy goal. So if you're really trying to work on a student to communicate with the teacher on their own, set a goal. But those are really hard to track if you don't give teachers a way to measure it. So is the student advocating yes or no? But what could that mean? Because once could be a yes, but really we want them doing it, you know, every time they have a question or 3 days a week. And so I make a scale and my base is I go off percentages, but I do change it as the goal progresses. But like a level 1 would be they're not advocating very often, maybe like 0 to 25% of the time. A level 2 might then be 26 to 55. A level 3 would be 56 through 85. And then a level 4 would be 85% or more of the time. And those are really arbitrary numbers and they're subjective to each teacher's opinion. But at least then it's consistent, they have a consistent scale to base the student off of every time. So it's still subjective, which so many things in education are, but it gives you a little bit more structure and consistency.
Yeah, I like that. And that's a great way for teachers to be able to have something tangible, I guess, in their thought process to align with for sure. And also, you know, I've heard people use data days where they're just taking those days to just input data and using touch points, you know, whether it's throughout the day or just mm-hmm. so they have this natural scheduled kind of event where they can collect data and make sure that they're really presenting that student the way that that student presents.
Right.
So how often do goals change?
Typically annually. So every time you renew the IEP, you're supposed to look at the goal with the team and see, are they making progress? If not, why? And if they are, great. And then whatever that answer was, do we want to change it? Usually you probably should. If they're not making progress, there's a problem. And so we either need to change the supports we're giving the student, or maybe the goal wasn't working for them. And so we probably want to change it then. And if they are making progress, then what's next? What's the next step that we want to live up to? So that's typically every year at the annual IEP, but any part of the IEP can be changed anytime during the school year.
What happens when a child meets all of their goals? Does that IEP go away, or what happens?
It can. If they have met their goals and are now meeting grade level expectations without needing extra supports, then the team can decide to exit the student off the IEP. But if they meet all their goals but are still struggling, then we just bump up to the next one. What's the next thing that we need to focus on that can help them if they still have any gaps or barriers that are getting into their way to general education?
And then is there like a set number of goals? Like, how are the amount of goals determined for a student, or the number of goals?
It depends on the team and kind of where they started. I always think 3 to 5 is kind of a sweet spot, but you would never kind of restrict it to those areas. You could have as few as 1. You could have as many as 12. I think the highest I've ever seen is 9. And there comes a point where there's too many and you can't work on all those things with the student. So that you kind of just have to take a look at what each goal is asking of the student, and what can be done in the school day, and what's going to be most efficient to kind of help narrow in and focus. And remember, they're only yearly goals. So even though there might be a ton of things we want to work them with, what's our highest priority in the next year that's going to make the most impact?
How can we develop ambitious, observable, and measurable goals?
I think knowing the student really well and kind of knowing where they're at. That's why my kind of 3 key things that I want everyone to know first is how to get that first narrative down. And then when we know kind of where they're at, so we know the goal we want to work on, but then build that off their strengths. I think that's how you get the ambition in there. Where are their strengths and how can we kind of challenge them in those areas to really get those ambitious goals that help us see progress for that student?
And then what about the observable and measurable part? I guess that would go back to the 4-point.
Yeah. If the goal doesn't naturally kind of have a way to measure it, that's my backup. I always go to the 4-point scale, but no matter how you write the goal, make sure that you can give qualitative and quantitative data on it. It doesn't always have to be numbers. Numbers just kind of help us track, but just make sure that you can speak well to it and give actual input of if the student's not missing the mark. So, you know, maybe a math goal, if they're struggling solving for X, Y, what is it that they're missing? Which kind of requires a little bit more work on maybe the case manager to really dig that out of the general education teachers. But once they get used to that, they can usually identify that really easily. They just don't know that they're supposed to. So takes that work too of a little bit of working with your staff and your school and just kind of setting that standard of when I'm asking for this goal feedback, here's the info I need.
How are behavioral goals measured? And what if a child is succeeding in one class, but then failing to meet goals in another?
Mm-hmm. Measurement could be if they have like a certain number of maybe behaviors, either we're looking for this many positive behaviors in a day, or, you know, 3 or fewer negative behaviors. It could be that could really vary greatly as well, depending on the goal, or you can use the 4-point scale to measure them. But then if they're succeeding in one class and not another, then I think you really need to take a deep dive into both those. What's working well in the class where they're succeeding and what's getting in the way in the class where they're not, and work with those teachers and that student and probably even the parents to figure out how we can duplicate that success in the other class as well. Because if something's working, we're doing something right somewhere. So let's see if we could figure that out and replicate it.
Have you seen, or do you have any advice on encouraging those positive behaviors that you would have perhaps outlined as behavioral goals?
Rather than writing them as a negative, you mean?
Right. Or just seeing that things that in the classroom, just kind of pivoting our conversation a little bit, but just kind of, have you seen some really great things that have worked to help support positive behavior in a classroom? I know we're kind of jumping out of the IEP, but just maybe to help kind of prevent the need for behavioral goals.
I think it's just the same thing anyone needs in life is just positive interaction. So saying hi to that student, saying it's good to see you, giving them responsibility in the classroom. So having them be someone that you come to count on. So give them a little task to do, or run this to another teacher for me, and just show that you trust them to do that. And as many positives as you can. And sometimes it's really, really hard to ignore the negative things that are coming. But that student likely, depending on what grade they are when they get to you, but they've probably had years and years of just hearing the things that they do wrong. And so if you are just not one of those people, they know it. They know that they're not supposed to behave like that. They don't need you to tell them that, but they need to know that you're not going to be one of those people who's going to write them off right away.
Definitely that consistency and that relationship building are huge mm-hmm. for any human.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
In and out of a classroom. How do we create goals that are successful in the classroom?
You really have to work with a general education teacher. Or if the student's going to be pulled out into a special education setting, kind of whoever is that teacher working on that goal with that student, what is it that works within that setting? So majority of my students were in the general education. We were working on their goals in that setting. And so as important as it is to fit that goal to the student's needs, I also needed to work with the gen ed teacher to fit that goal to what the gen ed class is going to be doing. Because when push comes to shove, the idea of the IEP is to help bridge that gap between them and the general education setting. So if we write a goal that doesn't work at all with the general education setting, then either we need to pull that student out to work on that goal, or that goal is just never going to be worked on and that student won't make progress. So really working with this environment that they're going to be practicing that goal and making sure that the goal works for both the student and that environment.
Do you have any tips that you share with folks that you train on encouraging that relationship and communication between general education and special education?
Kind of just like with the student, I'd stop by and check in with them. Say hi every once in a while. Don't always go and talk to them about the student and what you need them to do for the student. As much as you can, build that relationship. And I know that can be hard, and I'm an introvert myself, so I do not love socializing all the time, but I know that it's really important. So just do that and then thank them. Like the littlest things that they do, thank them for, you know, this accommodation they gave to that student or that compliment they gave to the student and you heard about it, let them know that was a big deal. And then I had a past administrator who did one thing I've never forgotten about, and I try to do it as much as I can. She would say to other people when I was there, oh, Megan is so good at this. And I remember thinking in my head, I don't know if I am, but if she believes in me that I am, I better step up and make sure I really am that good. And I so appreciated the compliment, but it also really made me sure I lived up to it. And so that was a really cool thing that she did for staff that I thought had amazing impact on her staff.
Absolutely. What a way to provide that positive interaction that will stick with you.
Yeah.
At what point should a child be or a student be aware of their IEP goals? And how should that conversation happen?
That's a great question. That really varies for the kid, depending on when they kind of, and how I think it's talked about at home and then talked about it at school amongst the teachers. There can be a stigma about it, although I think that's really starting to go away. But as long as it's the IEP is presented as a positive thing kind of over time, but the goals, whether you call them IEP goals or not, I think you start having that conversation with the student as soon as they have them. The teacher can just say, hey, here's where you're at right now, but we want you to get to here. So working on them so that they kind of have some buy-in with it and maybe can even help the process of what's working for them and what's not working for them. And I think even elementary school students can understand those concepts of achieving a goal, whether we call it an IEP goal or not. I think they should be brought in right away on knowing, you know, we want to get from here to here and working on them with that.
What is an example of a poorly written goal or an objective compared to a well-written goal and objective? So as a parent, they can kind of pop into that IEP and say, "Ooh, that's excellent," or "Wow, eek," or even another professional.
Yeah. For like a reading goal, it could be Johnny will improve his reading by 30%. And that sometimes the goal, that's all it is. So what, we don't know where he started. We don't know, what does that mean reading? Is he reading grade level passages? And are we trying to increase his comprehension to 30%? Are we trying to increase his fluency or his accuracy to 30% or from 30%? So if they're too broad like that and we don't know what is it that they're working on and where are they currently at, then we need to add a little bit more detail into them. Math goals, I think, are some of the hardest academic goals to write. And those ones, if you just see the standard, the whole standard written out in that thing, then that would be kind of a red flag of a goal, because then the math standards have so much going on in them. Which one of those things are we working on? And not only which of those things, but what's the skill that we need to get them to be successful in that standard? And so it's really that skill. I think the key is if they can read it and know exactly, like, you know, given a fifth grade reading passage, Johnny will increase his comprehension from 30% to 70%, then that's kind of clear. We know that when he's reading at the fifth grade level, we're trying to bump him up to 70%. And that's the goal, so that then once we hit 70, we can start looking forward to maybe sixth grade level.
And then even perhaps making sure that they have just kind of the setting, the presentation, you know, is it small group, is it large group, bigger, larger font, smaller font, kind of just how are we presenting that reading passage to the student, so that we can ensure that we have a consistent way of measuring the success for that kiddo.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
And so we've talked about present levels. We talked about goals and objectives. What about accommodations and modifications?
So accommodations, there's always kind of the standards. You see extra time, breaks, copies of notes. And those are great. And those are helpful for a lot of students. But you really need to know why. Why do they need it and when do they need it? And that's another thing, like with goals, you were saying when to bring the kid in on goals. I think they need to know their accommodations too, so that they know what to ask for and what they're even allowed to ask for. Sometimes they know they need help in something, but they didn't know they were allowed to ask for it. So accommodations really can vary. And general education teachers, in my experience, and parents give the best ideas for accommodations. So even though it's my area of expertise being a special education teacher, they see them, parents see them at home and have been working with them for years. And so they know what things help their student. And then general education teachers are able to see when they did this little thing in that setting, what really worked for them. I mostly saw them in my setting, which is usually a smaller group. And so they really can offer just great ideas for what worked. And usually they're pretty outside of the box ideas. So they are the people I go to the most for.
So we talked about accommodations and modifications, but how does that then, you know, kind of back to our three keys of writing exceptional IEPs, and we've covered those, but just kind of to flesh this all out, how does all that information create your services? How was the service page determined for a student? Kind of you've gotten through this IEP process.
The present levels typically are aligned with the student's goals. And so this is usually where they're at on the goals that we're working on together. And then those goals are what determine the specially designed instruction that we're going to give to the student or related services. They could have others that don't fall under instruction, but are a service that we provide. And that could be speech services, communication, physical therapy, occupational therapy. Sometimes those have goals. Sometimes it's just a service that may or may not have a goal related to it. So the present levels really lead into the goals, which lead into those services that we're going to give them. The classroom functioning and how the disability affects them in the general education, I think really lead to the accommodations and modifications a lot, so that if we know that something triggers them, we can put in an accommodation to try and reduce that trigger. Or if we know on the flip side, if they're really successful, if we do X, then we can also put that in as an accommodation. They can go both ways, but then those two pieces can really also lead into how we structure when we are writing goals, how we structure when we write goals, like you were saying with the setting of the goal. Maybe the student really struggles in the general education setting, but in a small group setting where there's not as many distractions, then they can actually kind of show their full potential or their full ability level in this one area. So knowing all that about that student can really help us set up those goals and those services much better.
We know that with IEPs and case management and special education, there is a lot of paperwork.
Yes.
What is your favorite productivity tool or resource that you're really loving on now that you kind of want to shout out to everybody you see and talk to?
Still Google Forms. I use those for just about everything. I send out Google Forms I worked at the high school levels. And so we need to get transition info from students and from parents. So I send out a form to them to try and get that information about transition from them. I send out forms to teachers to get general feedback. That form is where I get a lot of the ideas for accommodations. And it's also where I get kind of the picture of where their classroom functioning is at currently. And then, like I said, they have students also have the specific goal form set up. And then there's just like a parent form that I send home to get their input. And so I use anything and everything Google Apps that you can do to kind of help gather that info easy. And people are pretty, do a pretty good job with that, of getting that back. It's much more, I have a lot more success with that than if I just sent an email.
Yes, it is true, because it's just interactive. You can pop on it real quick, click, 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 and done. Mm-hmm. I love it. So kind of as we wind down this conversation, what should I ask you that I didn't know enough to ask?
That's a great question. I think just kind of how and where do you get this information? I know so many teachers get burnt out. And so where can they get all these tools to figure out how to make things work? And so to kind of answer that, on the flip side, there are so many resources. I don't know if teachers are into social media, but if you follow teachers on Instagram, they produce so many good ideas. And there's so many people, or Teachers Pay Teachers as a product. There are really some certain websites like understood.org gives a lot of great information. Really, I want to encourage teachers, rely on each other. Everyone has such good ideas, and anything I've ever built usually probably came from an idea that somebody gave me. And so just rely on each other. And if for no other reason than just for moral support, because it can be a tough job sometimes. And even like sometimes like it's fun to like look out on Instagram. I love Instagram because it's pretty positive, but you see this teacher who's on the other side of the United States is struggling with the same thing you are. And you think, thank God, it's not just me.
Yeah. You don't feel isolated, because mm-hmm. sometimes you can. The world of special education, like you said, you wear many hats. You are a teacher and a case manager, and you're really trying to kind of hone in on the little picture and look at the big picture of each individual kid. And I like how you said that, to kind of reach out and keep that communication line open with everybody professionally as well, and to have that support system. If you could have a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
Oh, that would be the communication. Like I said, I spent most of my career in the high school level, and it amazed me how many parents, when they got to me at high school, thought that the only time they got to come to me with questions or concerns was at their annual IEP meeting. Because I would wonder why I wouldn't hear from parents, and they'd come to these meetings, and then I would find out they didn't think they could. So as much as I encourage teachers to reach out to parents anytime and all the time that they can, also vice versa, as a parent, please reach out to your student's special education teacher or any of their teachers whenever you need to, and ask whatever questions you have, or state the concern that you're worried about. But keep that line of communication open, and know that we get to have it whenever.
To add to that, I would say that in my time when I was in the classroom, I've taught elementary through post-secondary. And I would say, to agree with you, the number of parents I spoke to, middle school, high school, that were identified on my caseload, and I would reach out to the parent for the first time, they automatically thought, what's wrong? And yes. So once they realized that, nope, I'm here, I'm on your team, let me help you, let's build these strengths together, it really changed that interaction, and also changed the feel when we sat down to create that IEP at a more formal setting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I can't thank you enough for your time and this conversation. And it's incredibly valuable for everybody, parents, professionals alike, to really kind of understand these key elements of an IEP, and to really kind of be more thoughtful in the sense of creating that classroom function, I think is a really excellent component we don't see a lot about. And then phrasing it to say, how does this disability impact the classroom, so that we can then be more informed as an IEP team to better develop and create a true individualized education plan for that student. So absolutely. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You bet.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.